invitation. It's always a pleasure to come here. And yeah, so I'm a bit the alternative guy of the conference, so I'll try to remind you of the other possibility to complete spin foams, which is to sum over them. And I'll try not to be too technical, so please interrupt as much as you want and ask questions. So here's the plan of the talk. So first I will introduce the alternative, summing versus refining. Then I will explain how the summing strategy can be implemented in something known as a group field theory, which are essentially generating functionals for spin foam amplitudes. Then I will, maybe something not many of you know, is a kind of tentative canonical interpretation of this formal generating functionals, which might give, it's incomplete so far, but it might give a perspective, so that's why I want to talk about it. Then I will focus on a restricted class, but general enough, of models which can be renormalized, and I will give you some examples. So this will be kind of the meat of the talk with a bit more details, but the main point probably is before. And then I will summarize. Okay, so summing versus refining. So you probably know all of this already, but still let me remind you. So the main success of loop quantum gravity is to provide a kinematical setup for talking about quantum geometries. And now we know this is not unique. There are at least two of them. And okay, so for example, in the old framework, in the Hsteka-Lewandowski formalism, the quantum geometry, quantum geometric states are labeled by graphs decorated with the SU2 representation data. And these are kinematical states, so the dynamics is not imposed. So the main question is how to impose the dynamics and to project these states down to, from a kinematical Hilbert space down to a physical Hilbert space. All right, and so spin foams is an avenue to define, is a strategy to define this projector P in a covariant path integral way. So the main output of a given spin foam model is a set of amplitudes which are labeled by two types of data. So first the boundary states, the quantum geometric states which live on the boundary, and an additional two complex structure which is kind of the bulk, which represent the bulk degrees of freedom. And in the construction of the spin foam amplitudes, the bulk stuff are summed over and in a way which is compatible with the boundary data. So that's it. And so the main point of this conference, I guess, this workshop, is that this is incomplete as a picture, because what one would like to get to define the projector on physical states is a set of amplitudes which are labeled by only the boundary data. So we need to have an additional organization principle to get rid of these extra combinatorial data which we introduced in the bulk. So at this stage, I think there are three possible interpretations. So first, maybe that's the end goal we would like to reach, is a set of amplitudes which actually don't depend on the extra structure we introduced, on the extra two complexes. But I will leave this possibility for now, because it's essentially equivalent to having, in Bianca's words, a perfect discretization from the outset. So maybe it's not so realistic in the 4D context. So the two other alternatives are to interpret the two complexes as regulators. So that's what we heard a lot about today, this week. And the second one is just to view them as specific histories, specific quantum processes of these quantum geometries that we love. Okay, so, and I will focus on the third point in the later part of the talk. So these two interpretations lead to two strategies to complete spinform models. So the lattice interpretations, which is kind of a generalization of usual lattice methods. And the second one is based on the QFT interpretation. And that's what I want to talk about today. So the idea is to sum over the extra two complexes that we artificially introduced with specific weights, which come from a field theory. And this is a group field theory. Okay, and this has been around for quite some time, and it was originally proposed by De Pietri, I think, mainly. Okay, so now it's time maybe to just give you a rough definition of what a group field theory is, otherwise you won't know what I'm talking about. So we'll see that it is related to the quantum gravity, but also to matrix and tensor models. So if you are familiar with them, it might be helpful. And a simple definition could be that a group field theory is something like a non-local quantum field theory defined on a group manifold rather than a space-time. So let me mention here that already that the group manifold that we will use in GFT is auxiliary, should not be interpreted as space-time. It's more like a symmetry group, local symmetry group of space-time. And rather the space-time interpretation should come from the Feynman amplitudes, which are these spin-form amplitudes. And so in a word, in a slogan way, summary, it's a QFT, it's supposed to be a QFT of space-time rather than on space-time. And the specific types of non-locality that we will introduce in this field theory correspond exactly to the type of combinatorial structure that we want to have in our space-time or space spin-form. So essentially, the interactions you will see they will be dual to the spinform vertices that you want to have in your model. Okay. So let me come back to the main line now that you roughly know what a GFT is. So in the two approaches to complete spinforms, the renormalization methods are central for two reasons, as usual. First, to guarantee that the description is consistent over scales, and one of the main difficulty will be to define what are these scales. And the second goal also is to provide practical tools to explore the different regimes of the theory and extract predictions or collective behaviors and things like this. So it's twofold. It's maybe more mathematical thing, conceptual thing, and more practical one, but that you know probably. So in the refining framework we heard about this week, this, I guess, can be viewed as a background-independent generalization of direct space renormalization methods. And with the big difference that the scale is the lattice itself in this approach, but you know that we heard about it repeatedly this week, and the consistency over scales is implemented into this notion of dynamical cylindrical consistency. So what about the summing framework, so the GFT idea? So you can view it also as a kind of background independent generalization of renormalization, but a momentum shell renormalization methods. It's more in this spirit. So in particular, the notion of scale that we will use will be just like in any other field theory, the will be related to the spectrum of some specific operator that we have in the model. So a two-body operator, we'll see what this means. And so it's more, there is not this additional difficulty of treating all the lattices as scales, but there is a one parameter scale. So it's a big assumption, I would say. And the consistency over scales is guaranteed not by cylindrical consistency, but by the usual RG flow of a field theory. But the difficulty will be in the non-local part. So to have renormalization methods that work in this kind of non-local field theory. Okay.
Yeah?
No, but it's not. So in a sense, it is local. That's why it works. But it's non-local in a combinatorial way. So it's non-local, but just because spinform building blocks are not points. That's the type of non-locality. So adding a field wouldn't change anything. I mean, if I understand correctly your question. But on the group, I mean, terms are in a sense local, but they have more variables, if you wish. So is it clear?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe why would you choose one of the two alternatives? So maybe it comes from, I would say, at this stage, taste, but it's a kind of different heuristic perspective. So in the consistent boundary formulation, so we heard many things during this week. So maybe the quantum geometries are kind of labeled by equivalent classes of discrete labels, discrete structures, and cylindrical consistency identifications of different discrete structures is very pretty much central. In the GFT, the idea is a bit different. So it's more based on a atomistic picture, like purely discrete picture of the LQG type degrees of freedom. And in particular, there's a new input, which is the assumption that there is a new observable given by the number n of building blocks, so to speak, the building blocks of quantum geometry. And okay, so at the level of in the bulk, so the spinform amplitudes, again, in the consistent boundary formulation, they are thought of as effective descriptions based on discretizations. In the GFT perspective, because you start from a kind of realistic atomistic picture, they will be thought of as fundamental processes. Okay. A big difference also is how topology is treated. So in the wait. Yeah. Well, you can always, in a sense, you can always say that the Bayer theory doesn't exist. No, what is important is the stack of effective descriptions. So it's fundamental process, but at a given scale, still. No, I would say. I mean, just like in any QFT, the Bayer theory is not really meaningful. No, it's just. But still, you think about them as fundamental processes. I mean. Yeah, maybe. All right. So in the consistent boundary formulation, the topology of space is fixed, and one works with embedded structures, which is handy in particular to talk about diffeomorphisms. In the GFT, this is an additional difficulty, but also maybe an opportunity. I don't know. The topology itself is dynamical, so when one can talk about topology changing processes, and because the structures are not embedded, there's this additional difficulty of talking about diffeomorphisms in a meaningful way. Okay, and just about the tools, that's what I said before, maybe. So on this side, one uses lattices. We heard a lot about tensor networks, and this is mainly numerical stuff, but which is efficient in a non-perturbative context. In GFT, this momentum shell renormalization is better suited maybe to the perturbative sector, but it's mainly analytical. So that's maybe the advantage of this side with respect to this side, and they are in a sense complementary. So okay. And one point I wanted to add is that in the GFT context so far, the question of the continuum limit has been addressed in maybe two steps. So first, we are focusing on renormalizing the bulk dynamics with keeping the boundary fixed but arbitrary. So there is no mixing between the boundary and the bulk. And so this question is really about whether the QFT is consistent, but we don't touch so much the boundary states. And this will be a second step, which is probably as hard, will be to construct interesting boundary states, which are, which will be most probably in this context will be many body states. So there's this additional difficulty of constructing these states because it's not an approximation. I mean, it's not thought of as an approximation. So in principle, even a completely homogeneous state will have, will be a many body state, but described in a statistical way. Okay. In terms of these building blocks of space, so yeah, so it's really tied to the interpretation, and okay, you can agree or not, and find it attractive or not, but it's the idea, I would say. Okay, so now let me give you a bit a bit more flesh. So, what is the idea? How you generate spin foams from these GFTs? So, let me point out that there are two aspects in GFT, maybe one aspect which is not so present in the standard LQG. So first is the algebraic aspect, I would say. So what types of dynamics, what type of fields you want to talk about. And this kind of data, they really come from the loop quantum gravity and spin foam models. So what would you just encode in the GFT the same data that you have on this side. But there is an extra layer of questions which are purely combinatorial and which are important actually in this context. So the type of questions you would ask is, what are the spin network boundary states which I want to describe? So in general, we will see that in GFT, you very often restrict the valency of the spin network graphs you want to describe. And the same question can be asked in the bulk. So what type of spin foams you want to sum over at the combinatorial level? And we'll see again that it's simpler to restrict the valency, or at least restrict in some way the combinatorial structure. And and there's a relation with topology, so I won't enter the details here, but in the GFT one can impose local restrictions on how the different building blocks of the spin foams are glued together, but no global ones. So there is, so you can in a way control the topology, but not completely at the combinatorial level. So you cannot decide from the outset that you would sum, for example, on manifold structure. You can decide that you will sum over locally manifold structure, but you might have more global issues. So, yeah, so maybe that's just a remark.
That's the whole, I mean, is it, so just to get this last right, the restriction that I see is to the specification, or is the whole as well that didn't yet like the specification variable and then it doesn't matter?
Like here, triangulation independence is a bit hard to talk about because you don't have one.
Yeah.
So.
That this restriction in the end doesn't really physically matter.
No, I think it has to physically matter. So my point was more to say that there is an extra layer of difficulty, which is that there is an interplay between the combinatorial structures and the algebraic content of your field theory, which has to be exploited if you want to in a way get rid of the junk that you are generating in this group field theory. Because you in the group field theory, what you can encode is the local way you are gluing spin foam vertices in a way. So this local way, you have a direct control on it. But this is not enough to really decide on what classes of spin foams you are summing over. So, and the way you uniquely separate the things that you are able to interpret in terms of geometry from those you are not able to interpret in terms of geometry has to come from the interplay between these two lines. And that's a new aspect which you don't see in a discretization context because you just choose your discretization. Okay. Okay, and the other reason why I talk about this combinatorial stuff is that there's been a strong interplay between matrix models, tensor models on the one side, and group field theory in recent years. And this is what unlocked like many of the new results that have been proven in GFT. And okay, what? And as a pedagogical maybe way, I think it's if you understand the combinatorial structures of matrix and tensor models, you understand that of GFT. So I will introduce the combinatorial structures to matrix models and tensor models. So maybe you are already familiar with this. So matrix models, so they are statistical models for matrices, and they are related to the statistical models of 2D surfaces. How? So let me explain that. And this is the same idea that will be used in tensor models and GFT. So the idea is that a matrix is something with two indices, right? So the trace of M cube here that I have in this partition function is a contraction of three matrices along their common indices. So I can represent it like this. So I contract J with J, K with K here, and I with I. So this is the trace of M cubed. And this, if you think about it, is really dual to a triangle. So this, yeah. Okay, so this is dual to a triangulation. So the first thing I drew here is a kind of vertices for this statistical model. A vertex for this statistical model, and these vertices will be glued through the kinetic term in perturbative expansion. So when expanding in terms of lambda, this will play the role. This first factor will give you the notion of propagator, and these will be the vertices of your theory. And so in this expansion, what you sum over is over bunches of vertices like this, which are glued together with propagators like this, which identify the indices on one side to the indices on the other side. Okay, is that clear? Okay, so if you have this picture in mind, you will understand that the Feynman graphs of the theory that you generate in this perturbative expansion are really triangulations of surfaces. All right. And the nice aspect of this particular model in 2D is that this expansion through a suitable rescaling. So I forgot to say something here. So here n is the size of the matrix. So they are n by n matrices. And it enters as a parameter of the partition function. And the idea is to let n go to infinity. So if you have an appropriate rescaling of this coupling constant by n, you can organize this perturbative expansion in terms of the topology of the surfaces that label the Feynman amplitudes. And in particular, you will see that the dominating contribution here, so R with G equals zero here, and they are labeled by the genus. So G is basically the number of holes in the surface. Okay, so, but the only point I wanted to get through here is really this purely combinatorial idea of having a field theory in which vertices are viewed as elementary building blocks that you glue together through a propagator. And that in this way, you have this relation between this partition function and a statistical sum over triangulations, okay? Maybe I don't need to talk about that, but this kind of model can be related to 2D quantum gravity, but we don't really care here, I guess. Okay, so then the idea was, if I want to talk about GFT, we want to reproduce this kind of idea, but in higher dimension. So the basic idea that have been explored in the 90s was to replace the matrices with objects with more indices. So tensors, for example, in 3D, tensors with three indices. And instead of summing over triangulated surfaces, you would sum over triangulated three surfaces, which are made out of elementary building blocks, which are tetrahedra here. So here is a contraction of, in the same way as here, of tensor indices in the shape of a tetrahedron. They will be viewed as elementary building blocks of your triangulations. And then these tetrahedra are identified just like there through their boundary. They are glued by the propagator through their boundary triangles, okay? So you can do that. The problem is the new difficulty that starts appearing in 3D is what I was mentioning before, is that you get absolutely no control over the topology with these local gluing rules of tetrahedra. So basically why? Because you generate not only well-behaved triangulations of manifolds, but completely arbitrary gluings of 3D simplices, which can lead to very pathological topologies. And that's related to it. This, for the same reason, you don't get this this expansion in terms of the topology of the triangulation that we had in 2D. And so let me mention one point here that will be important for the rest of the talk, is that this state of the art has changed relatively recently. And it has been understood that if one views these tensors as having really, as having, let's say, no symmetry over the indices here. So if one labels these indices, let me say it differently. So if one introduces a large symmetry in terms of for these tensors, which is a UN cross D symmetries here, where D is the number of indices in the tensors, one can actually reproduce the 1/n expansion result of matrix models, though in a context which is not as beautiful, maybe, because you lose the topological character of the expansion. But through this technical improvement, which is to see the tensors, to impose a big invariance, let's say, on this type of interactions, you can reproduce some of the results we had in 2D. And this is the technical input that led to the new developments I will talk about later. So, but let's see this as a parenthesis here. Okay, so now, what is the idea of a group field theory? So it's to say, okay, it's a group field theory, is a tensor model, just like the one before, except that the tensor indices now live in a group manifold. So I want to introduce non-trivial algebraic data, so I want to go away from this purely combinatorial perspective. So I say that the group elements, the indices here, G, I, live in a group manifold. And so the structure of the partition function, the general structure of a partition function of a GFT will be like this. So you integrate over all the fields, and you have exponential minus some action here. And the important terms are these kernels here. So these things here that I denoted the V dot phi NV are specific convolutions of the fields here, specific contractions of the tensor along their indices, and this term, the specific term that you have at order 2, will play the role of a gluing rule of the propagator. So this will be the elementary spin foam vertices, let's say, and this will be the gluing rule for the elementary spin foam vertices. So in other way, maybe it's this K here. Here will play the role of the edge projector that Benjamin and Medibody talked about this week. Okay, and maybe in the, let's say that in the the renormalization program for GFT I will talk about, the crazy idea, let's say maybe, is to take this formal partition function seriously as a field theory and see how far we can go with it. So in particular, a partition function like this will be generically divergent, so you need to regularize it here with the cutoff to make it concrete. And the idea is to say, okay, is this theory consistent when I change the cutoff? So is it renormalizable? And what kind of physical output can I get from it if I really take it seriously as a physical model? But okay. And so this program, let's say it goes in three steps. So first there is the model building step, which is to define the theory space here. So define the set of spin foam vertices one wants to work with, and the kind of constraints or projectors one wants to work with at the level of the edges. Okay, and this construction, this model building really amounts to translating the spin foam amplitudes one wants to sum over here into this kind of elements. And there's a correspondence which always works. And the additional input are these combinatorial considerations. So you want to have a control over the combinatorics of these terms. So you won't insert any type of interaction, but some which are you think are more important. Then the second goal is to check whether this expansion here, this equality here, is consistent. So to check whether the correspondence between the spin foam models you are summing over and the field theory is consistent when the cutoff changes. Okay, so that's the second step. And it's more of a formal step, you see, because you say, okay, I start from a spin foam model and then I encode that into a field theory. So this field theory might not make sense as a perturbative field theory, which is, okay, why not? But if it's not the case, you completely lose the connection between the things you want to sum over in the first place and your field theory. So I think it's an important check. And this, the third one, which is even more important, I would say, is to, once you have a theory which is consistent somewhere in the theory space, is to explore this theory space and try to find a regime where you have a relation between this model and a continuum GR. But that's a long-term perspective, I would say. And so far, we are starting to understand these two points. Okay, are there questions maybe now, or that's okay? Okay, so now, so I showed you how GFTs can be used as generating functionals for spin foam amplitudes, and then I told you, okay, so let's take this generating functional seriously as a field theory. So it sounds a bit far-fetched, I would say, because you just assume that this makes sense as a QFT, and you try to, therefore, you try to renormalize it, but that this might be just a formal relation. So because of that, I think there's a quite recent perspective on this idea, is which has been proposed by Daniele Oriti, which is to really try to understand this formalism of a GFT from a canonical perspective. So this picture is not completely clear yet, I would say, but still I want to talk about it because I think it can give perspectives and it pinpoints what are the physical assumptions that you make when you say, okay, I will take the GFT seriously as a field theory. So the questions we want to ask is, first, what is the relationship between GFT and canonical LQG? So at least at the heuristic level, what is the physical interpretation of the GFT field? And the third question, which is basically, I think, not answered, is how to extract the physical projector, the loop quantum gravity physical projector, from the GFT partition function I was telling you about before. Okay. So to to get a better relation between this GFT abstract GFT formalism and the canonical perspective, Hilbert space for GFT has been constructed, and it is based on a different kind of Hilbert space as the LQG one, though the type of degrees of freedom one works with, the type of data is still the same. So we're still talking about spin networks, but embedded in a different Hilbert space. So this construction, let's say that the main difference is that there is no embedding, as I said already. So there will be no embedding of spin network states. And partly because of that, the construction will be based on a Fock representation, a Fock Hilbert space. And so the idea is, if you want to construct a Fock space, is you have to understand what is the one particle Hilbert space. So you have to get a notion of elementary building block that you would then use to build a Fock space. So in GFT, as they are currently defined, the building blocks are the divalent open spin network. So the idea is that you view any spin network state here as a gluing of elementary pieces, which are these divalent spin networks. So you assume that's a physical that's an assumption. Let's say physical, I don't know, but that's an assumption, which is to say, okay, I will view this as an elementary chunk of space, which is physically. Which is then used to build up these more complex states of geometry. Okay, so the idea is to view to assume that the one particle Hilbert space of this GFT Fock space is the space of is a Hilbert space associated to the elementary open spin network nodes here. So in dimension D, you will actually, it's natural or simpler, let's say it's simpler to restrict the valency of the spin network nodes you are considering. So in dimension D, you would assume that the one particle Hilbert space is this H of V here, which is L2 of GD, so SU2 to the D in the case of 4D quantum gravity, with a gauge invariance at the node here. What can I say? So, yeah. Yeah. So that's the main, one of the main differences is that there is no cylindrical consistency assumed. So I think the idea is to say, okay, if I drop the assumption that I embedded into a continuous manifold, then it makes sense to really take seriously the excitations of geometry as geometric excitations over the no space state, let's say. So and there is no way, if you do that in an abstract way a priori, to identify different states. Yeah, of course you can exclude the JGL zero states from here. Why? Sorry.
Do we interpret J equal to zero as corresponding to some area spectrum 1/2? That would just mean that you have that if you say your space is particles,
mm-hmm.
and instead of saying something there is a particle which has zero volume, which
yeah,
you say that if there's a particle it has always minimal volume.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, this notion of cylindrical consistency is sometimes just a cumbersome way of writing. You can't can write a view actually better than this because it's the direct sum. You don't need to have this
GX. Actually, there's also some other solidarity consistency there because this is the number of particles and it is now. In Fox space, there's also some solidarity consistency.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And it's putting in what you see. It's putting in that the number of orbitals is non-orbital.
Yeah, I think it's an assumption. It's not unique also. This construction, you can a priori do it for different types of different notions of building blocks of quantum geometry. So, but I'm just presenting you what is the construction which underlies the current GFT models. So.
Reference. I mean, this idea of Fox space is not like the first guy that proposed it was just after one of you that we proposed it.
Mikovic? Yeah, I forgot to.
So it goes back to. It's not new.
I'm not saying it's new. I think it was in the. Yes, sorry. I think it was. People were interpreting this. Formalism in this way from the beginning is just that I wanted to make more concrete maybe there. Okay, so this Fox space is a stack of states which are completely disconnected. You see, so this GFT, these spin network nodes are open, and the usual gauge invariant closed spin network states of LQG, they can be constructed from basically convolutions of these states. So I won't present the details, but you can project down these open spin networks to closed ones. Okay, so the usual LQG states are lie in a subspace of this bigger Hilbert space, and it destroys what?
This projection depends on the type of subgraph.
Yeah, sure. No, so it's not. It's not, no, it's not. What I mean is that is. No. What I mean is it's not a projector. I didn't mean to say that there's a projector operator which projects that. No. That's not what I meant. It's just that given a graph, you can construct from a state like this. A state which is labeled by a graph, okay, and that's it.
But I guess the reason this part of picture never really worked out because of that, because it works out there's no gauge inference. The usual gauge inference requires you to know.
Yeah, to add.
That the Fox structure is completely.
Yeah, it's.
Unintelligible about. And there's no way you can talk about this gauge inference answering about this.
I agree, but you can construct states which are labeled by these graphs and that lie in the Fox space. They are linear superpositions of elementary Fox states. Okay. But though, even if you do that, well, let's say you do that, and the GFT Hilbert space and LQG ones, they kind of coincide on the fixed graph. So the scalar product the scalar product of the GFT side mimics the one of the LQG side, but otherwise they are quite different because, as I said already, the emphasis is put on the number of building blocks. So in particular, GFT states which don't have the same number of nodes are orthogonal to each other because they lie in different factors here. N, which is not true in the LQG Hilbert space. So there is a big departure from the usual construction, but that's what it is. Okay. And the other point I want to make, yeah.
I guess HGFT cannot talk about gauge inference at all. So that's the point. HAPG appears in the stuff, so you talk about connectivity, I don't even know what you can write with GFT.
But
there's no graph.
No, but within the
notion of Fock space is never
implemented. But within the Fock space, you can construct states which are specific convolutions of the basic states, and you can view that you can encode that convolution in a graph. Okay.
Yeah, but essentially, it means that you can embed HFQ genes.
Like that. Yeah, that's what I meant.
Right.
So.
But there's no way you can, by natural operation on the Fock that you are create which it can be.
No, there is no linear, there's no operator which would send GFT to HLQG, I agree.
The problem with the GFT is that it misses the main point, which is the agent bias. Yeah, it ignores
the agent bearing part of the subspace of that.
Yeah.
No, but which one? You can't, that's the point. Yeah, because, look, in this HDFT, there's an infinite number of ways of the gauge bind. Each time you take a graph,
that's true.
There's a gauge. So, if you could define the notion of gauge bind independently of the graph, then it's not like there's a subspace of HDFT which is a gauge bind subspace. It's just
that I agree. So,
you know, so that's why it's not like it's a bigger hyperspace of HFQ and HFQ, that would be useful.
No, the relation is more complicated.
The graph breaks that. I mean,
but can't you take take a spin network function which has n vertices. Can't you build out of that an n body operator that creates
this?
You act with this on your Fock vacuum?
Well, no, the point is to create some kind of Fock algebra which creates graphs, and that's, you know, nobody has been able to
do
that.
You
so
can
if
do.
You can destroy the graph, of course you have creation. Question of whether there's some kind of Fock algebra which naturally acts on the graph and creates another graph, destroying nodes in the graph, things like that.
So that's that, no, for now. But what Wolfgang said, I think you can do it. No, I just wanted to say what Wolfgang said, you can do it, and that's what I had in mind. Then what you said, I think you cannot do it, and I agree. So,
I mean, maybe because
also, that's what I wanted to say, is that this construction a priori is not tied to the specific decomposition of spin network states that you have in mind. You could think of using different building blocks, like, I don't know, plaquettes or things like this, and then maybe it's better.
So can one understand it in the sense that different choices of graphs within vertices are all in there, it's just that they aren't orthogonal?
Yes. That's
but
correct.
That's also for the HPG Hilbert space. If you exclude J equal 1, they are all orthonormal.
So
no,
but here they are.
Right?
Yeah.
Here they are not orthonormal.
Yeah.
So
here, states which are based on two different graphs, in the way Wolfgang was saying, and have the same number of nodes, they won't be orthogonal while in the GFTK, in the LQG case, yes. That's what you meant, no? Oh. So there are big differences. I mean, I don't want to mean that that's the way or something like this, but just that's the picture. So my point was just to say that, I mean, the main point was to say that there is, if you want to view GFTs as a really physical models, the extra input that you are introducing, I think, is something like this, that
so
there is an observable.
Because of the symmetrization of the vertices. So if I have two graphs which have different edges labeled, they're really
No, not in general.
Wait,
Because they will lie in the same factor, the Fock representation.
Yeah, two spin network states which are different spin labels, then they're going to be autonomous. I mean, if there's no symmetrization that exchange the data.
But there is a symmetrization here.
I'll give you an example of two different graphs with different spin labels which are not autonomous in that topic.
What?
Two
different spin network states.
Different spin network states, which are autonomous in HPLTG, will be autonomous in that
topic. Not in general.
If you have two different graphs, say, take all the spins the same, with the same number of vertices, but different combinatorics.
Yeah, unless there's some symmetry. If the spin labels are different, they would be autonomous.
Yeah.
So the only difference is some kind of symmetry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's say where
it could be is that all the spins are the same. So this is when the spins are not. So the difference is not major. It's
just, no.
No, because you have to change the whole vertex, not the edge.
So let's say that, to wrap it up, that the difference between HGFT and LQG is that in LQG, maybe the emphasis is put on the graph structure, while in GFT, only on the number of nodes, in a sense. And, okay.
But it seems also that one tells you, okay, maybe, that one puts the number of nodes to the fourth one.
Because to the fourth?
I mean, one puts lots of emphasis on the number of nodes, but it's actually not even the gauge on my end of the so it doesn't label a really nice integration plan of the world. Isn't there some way to replace it and limit it to some space of each one of the others?
I'm trying to think about it, but I don't know. Okay. And maybe I'll move on. So the other point I wanted to make here, so let's not spend too much time on it, is that in this formalism, the GFT partition function assumes the interpretation of a kind of grand canonical ensemble rather than really projecting on the physical states. You see that it's more akin to a partition function like this. So instead of implementing f equals 0 here, this is the projection on Hamiltonian constraint in this formalism. You have something like this with the chemical potential. And so it is, I think, an open problem to try to understand how you would extract this f equals 0 sector from this partition function. And that's been pointed out repeatedly, but in this context, you see it like through this kind of a formula. So there is a limit to be taken, in particular, maybe a classical limit or a zero temperature limit. And this is an open question, okay? And this is related to the fact that you have topology changing processes in this function.
It's
a chemical potential for. So in the GFT action, it comes from the fact that you have the propagator. I mean, it comes from these the M squared terms. Even in the ultra local context, is the fact that if you don't have this mu, I think you get the wrong sign of for the propagator. You get
what do you call N here?
Yeah.
No, it's not. No, the beta is the
H-bar. I think that, if I remember well, this mu is needed if you want to make the propagator, the kinetic term, appear with the right sign, I think.
But can you identify from the GFT action? So let's say you have two parameters.
So
which one is better, which one is new?
So you will have more parameter because in F you will have all possible spin foam vertices. So they will be labeled by coupling constants. So beta is just a factor, okay? You can say, okay. But mu,
beta
what? Yeah.
In your action, you have exponentially 1 over lambda
mm-hmm.
times your kinetic term plus potential.
Mm-hmm.
So k
plus. Yeah.
Okay.
So I wanted to say. So I think in principle, you could go away with this factor mu n. In principle, you could go away with this factor mu n, but if you don't include it, you can see that I have to check. But I think that you can see that the kinetic term will have the wrong sign. It will be, instead of being exponential minus phi squared, it will be exponential plus phi squared.
I'm just asking, if you write down the GFT action, what is mu in the GFT action?
So mu is something, so let's say, so let's say mu is a k. It's like the kinetic term. To put it simply.
Like it's mu times k?
No, that's what I said, is that there's a factor which comes from F, which will be weighted
mu
by something. Yeah, mu is some function of M, of the factor. So, I don't remember, but if you have the action which is like something like, let's say you have a parameter here, m time the kinetic term, okay, which is order 2 plus higher order terms. If you don't include this mu, m will be necessarily a negative of the wrong sign. That's what I said. So mu is something.
Here you're starting from there. I want you to tell me, you start from there and you write it
like that.
So
it's. So m will be something like 1 plus mu or something like this, and you have and you need mu to be negative enough or something like this. But I don't remember the details, so maybe it's not worth it to. Okay. So that's it. Maybe I'll skip this. I have more time. Yeah. It's I had the long. Yeah. Okay. So now let me try to give you a flavor of what we can technically do in GFTs. And let me spend some time on so-called tensor GFTs, because they are these models that we are able to deal with for now. And so, so the type of models we have been working with in the last few years are based on combinatorial restrictions, which come from tensor models. And so basically what it amounts to is to impose some colorable restrictions on the spin foam faces meeting at a vertex in the spin foam expansion. So, roughly, okay? And then, if you want to do renormalization in this context, you need the notion of scale. And the notion of scale we have been using so far is based on derivative operators that are added in the GFT action and which are not present usually in the spin foam model. So these are also extra inputs that are necessary in this context, but maybe not forever, okay? It's just for now, they have been necessary. About the spin foam dynamics, so what we have been able to do so far is to implement the Gauss constraint, so to have really a spin foam with a discrete connection. but simplicity constraints have not been completely dealt with for now, okay? And the methods that we've been using are mainly perturbative renormalizability, but now there's an important effort, in particular on a functional renormalization group, which are implemented numerically and which are used to uncover non-trivial fixed points in the space of theories, okay? So let me skip this, it's useless for now. So the specific restrictions I was talking about that we use from tensor models amount to imposing some colorable conditions. And I don't want to enter the details here, but the idea is that the spin foam vertices now are labeled by you have infinitely many possible combinatorics for the spin foam vertices, and they are labeled by specific graphs, which correspond to specific contractions of the GFT fields. And I don't need to explain what they are, but they are what they are. Okay, it's not useless, but it's useless here. But so what the main point is that each of these drawings here in the GFT action will be elementary kernels for spin foam vertices, okay? And you see that you have infinitely many possible of them, possibly, with the arbitrarily numbers of faces meeting at a given vertex. So a key point, if you want to do randomization, is really to work with the reservoir of couplings, which is large enough, flexible enough, so that you can renormalize divergences. So, and this is what we have been using. So, and what makes these interactions useful in this context? So it's not that they are physically preferred, because we don't know that, but at least in the space of all possible spin foam interactions, these interactions are stable enough. So if you start in theory space from this, so suppose you have a theory space here and you start from these interactions at some scale, you remain in this small subset of theory space when you run the randomization group. So that's why we have been using them, not because we think that they are the best. Okay. So then the notion of scale that we use is based on the Fourier modes of the GFT fields. So for example, if you work with a field on SU2, you will use the spin levels of the harmonic expansion of this field as scales. And what I will call in the following UV scales will be large values of the spins, and infrared scales will be small values of the spin. And why is that? So from the geometric perspective, maybe it's cumbersome, but the reason is just because from the QFT perspective, the high spins is where you have all the divergences coming from. And so it's where you have most of the degrees of freedom in the QFT come from the large J's, not the small ones. So that's why they are called UV here. And okay, and the idea, maybe, which kind of makes sense from a physical perspective, is to flow from the UV to the IR, that is to explore dynamics from the dynamics of large building blocks in the spin foam expansion to smaller ones. So maybe it's consistent naively with the continuum limit, but that's just hand waving. Okay, and more specifically, so here's the type of models we have been using. So this S interaction, so this is the GFT action. This S interaction is the sum over the discolored patterns I was talking about before, arbitrary one. And the propagator is a sum of Laplace operators on the group associated to each entry of the field. So the field has D entry in this space time dimensions, and you have one such operator per entry, okay? So that's one point. And if you want to construct interesting GFT models from the point of view of spin foams, you need to impose additional constraints on the fields, which essentially implement the Gauss constraint or the simplicity constraint. So in the GFT context, these constraints translate into the fact that you don't want to integrate over all possible fields in the partition function, but you want to integrate over fields with a certain invariance. And this is implemented by a modification of the measure here. So this is a measure, a Gaussian measure. So this term here encapsulates both the measure of, on the field and the kinetic term. So it encapsulates the propagator. Here C is the propagator. And the propagator won't be chosen simply as the inverse of this operator, but we will impose extra projections here, which are what implement actually like the Gauss constraint or the simplistic constraints. Yeah.
In this action that you write in the second line with this colored diagrams
here. No. No. So you're right. There is no tetrahedron here. So that's also why I was saying before that these graphs are interesting because these interactions are interesting because they are stable enough. But maybe from the geometrical perspective, we are excluding stuff that you wouldn't exclude in general. So, but that's a starting point. I would say that's not. So to put it shortly, there is no tetrahedron here. And there is no four simplex in for the. But these are toy models, okay? I don't want to make them bigger than what they are. It's really to learn how it works. Okay, let me skip this. And so let me give you now some examples of models we have been looking at. So the first general class of models in this tensor invariant models I was talking about are so-called gauge invariant models. So the invariance you impose on the field, so the P operator I was talking about, will only impose this kind of invariance, okay, here. And this amounts to, this is the, basically amounts to implement the Ponzano-Reggie type edge projector that you heard about this week. So no simplicity constraints, but gauge invariance, okay, at the level of the amplitudes. Okay, and the propagator becomes something like this. So here I wrote the inverse of the Laplacian in terms of the heat kernel of an SU2 integrated over the time parameter. And the divergences, just like in any field theory, they come from the small time, the small times here, okay? And so you need to cut that off. So that's the cutoff, okay? And at the level of the amplitudes, if you write that, so basically the GFT expansion will give you a sum over spin foams of a specific type. So these spin foams, which are colorable and that I didn't explain what they are exactly. But for each face in this spin foam, so this is a face of the spin foam, you will have exactly a kind of a flatness constraint, but except that it won't be implemented by a delta function, but by something more regular, which comes from this this type of propagator. So the propagator is not a delta, but some heat kernel integrated over. So in the amplitude, you won't have flatness, but you would have almost flatness, let's say, okay? Okay, and these specific models have been completely classified according to the dimension, so the number of group elements you have in the fields and the dimension of the group. And in particular, I think some models which are interesting at these two here, because you see you are in D equals 3, so supposedly three-dimensional space-time. And for a group of dimension 3, so for example SU2, you have a renormalizable model. And it's renormalizable for spin foam vertices, which are in which like whose boundary have up to six triangles glued over, okay? And if you vary the group dimension, still in this in this three-dimensional space-time context, you can have other models which are will be renormalizable, but up to 5-4. And okay, the reason why I think it's interesting is that it really mimics what you have in usual Euclidean field theories. So you know that in scalar field theories, in dimension 3, you get a 5-6 renormalizable model, and in dimension 4, you get a 5-4 renormalizable model. So here you have the same thing, except that the dimension which is relevant is the dimension of the group. Okay, so that's a nice playground, because we can then try to generalize to play with the usual methods of scalar field theories in this context. And okay, that's what I want to spend some time on maybe now. Yeah.
What's in the case of dimension 4, the dimension of the group was 2. Which group was that?
You went to the 2?
Okay, anyway. So why doesn't dimension 4 and just taking 1 do 1 does not work?
I know it works. So here, here in the classification, I just put the so the renormalizable models which have infinitely many divergences, infinitely many divergent graphs. So okay. They're just renormalizable models, not the. So you know you have several types of renormalizable theories. So those in which the number of Feynman graphs which diverge is finite, and those in which the number of divergent graphs is infinite, but you can still renormalize. And the kind of non-trivial ones are more the.
But I would always expect that if you put as gauge group a product of two groups, then the whole state sum just factorizes into one for each group, unless you have some non-trivial interaction.
I know, but here you have the.
So my question is.
So here the renormalizability comes from the. Why? Yeah, you went to 3, it would work, but I fail to see why. Because you see the fact that it diverges badly or not is really an interplay between the what you have in the interaction, so the type of group, etc., and the kinetic the propagator, which decays in 1 over something, but this 1 over something doesn't change with the dimension of the group, because it's what. So basically, in this class of model, actually, maybe I can say it like this: the structure, the degree of divergence of a graph will be something like minus 2 the number of lines, plus something here, so the number of face minus some rank here, but it doesn't matter, which depends here on the dimension of the group. So basically, this stuff doesn't change with the group. It comes from the fact that you have a second order kinetic term, but this changes with the group. So, all right, so let me give you a flavor. So now if you look at, let me give you some features. So just take this as a mathematical facts, which might be interesting for the future. And so if you take a model with the dimension 3 I was talking about and the dimension 4 group, so for example, this one, you see that there are only 2 relevant parameters in the action, which are this kind of phi 2 interaction and this kind of phi 4. This phi 4 interaction, and you can actually compute the flow of this coupling constants. Okay, and what you see, which is maybe interesting, is that the wave function renormalization in this procedure is so strong that you get a minus sign here in the flow of the phi 4 coupling constant, which you don't get in usual field theory, and this makes the model asymptotically free. So that is this U4 coupling, when you send the cutoff to infinity, goes to zero. So there is a generation of a scale. And okay, and that's interesting. So in a sense, these models are this model in particular is UV complete. You can define it at any scale. There is no Landau issue, and this is completely different from a usual scalar field theory. So whether it's interesting for quantum gravity, I don't know, but that's a fact. Now the second type of things that were tested, for example, is to try to analytically continue the dimension of the group, just to get a handle of what happens when you go from dimension 4 to dimension 3 of the group, which is maybe dimension 3 is what we are interested in here because it's SU2. And so you can do this, you can play this game, and you see that the only difference is that, okay, you still have these two relevant couplings, but the 5-4 couplings acquire some dimension, some canonical dimension, and this creates this new term here, okay, which is a of order epsilon in this expansion. And you see that because of that, there is an analog of the Wilson-Fisher fixed point that you have in usual scalar field theories, okay? Just a fact. And the only caveat, maybe, is that this Wilson-Fisher fixed point has opposite signs with respect to the usual scalar field theory. So there is a whole question of stability, which is not clear at all. But formally, you have a Wilson-Fisher fixed point, and this is an hint that maybe these GFTs have a rich phase structure, maybe. Okay. And now, when you go to SU2, so things become a bit more complicated because you have two additional order 6 couplings which become relevant and drive the renormalization rule flow, but still you can compute the beta functions. But now it's complicated, okay, because you have a four coupled flow equations. And okay, the conclusion, you can analyze them actually, but the conclusion is that this model, unlike the dimension 4 model, is not asymptotically free because of weird non-linear effects, but it may be asymptotically safe. So it opens again the question of whether there are non-trivial fixed points in the space of theories, okay? And just to open up the discussion maybe, these questions have started to be explored now with the non-perturbative methods, which are based on the a functional renormalization group flow. So the idea, if you are familiar with that, you have the two types of them, essentially the Vetterich equation, which is an equation for the generating function of one particular reducible graphs, and the Polchinski equation, which is more about the effective action. And there are new results now on this, and we are starting to be able to treat also these gauge invariant models and to check numerically whether they are non-trivial fixed points, new phases of these models, which are not seen in the perturbative analytical calculation. So that's maybe the promising path, I think, in this randomization study.
Can you summarize what's happening with the Polchinski
I don't really know because I haven't read this paper. It's not out yet, but I know that they are. So Thomas told me that they are using it as a kind of formal equation to just define the effective action for. So T is a kind of regulator that they introduce, and they want to define the effective action for T equals 1 starting from 0. So if they have a flow from 0 to 1 or something like this, and I think the key, I think they recover. So for now, they have tested the formalism on a purely combinatorial model, so tensor-like models, no gauge invariance, no nothing. But I think they recovered the kind of universality results that Razvan has proven. So I don't know I don't know the details, but I know that they are able to work with disconnected interactions in this formalism, and they play an important role. So I think the main message of Thomas is that these disconnected contributions are important in this formalism, and that you should include them, otherwise it's not consistent. But I don't know more.
Geometrically,
why?
They're problematic in terms of vulnerability.
You mean this handle? No. Why?
Because the way you want to be the manifold is by, you know, connected to so the fact that this piece is
stuck. Yeah, so but. So as I said, for now they have looked only at, they didn't look at quantum gravity or anything. They have looked at the tensor models and tried to understand the structure of correlation functions from this equation.
You didn't emphasize that because I think there was something that Ben Joseph did.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's an important point because yeah. Here, when you talk in such a generality, this is really not a problem.
Okay.
It's an important point because Ben Joseph was the first one to know this. You're not talking about it. Maybe a very deep, something where this type of anomalization and locality is very, very different from the one we use in music theory.
Yeah, because I have no comment, no thoughts on that. But no, I agree. In principle, there is no reason to exclude them. But let me just say that at this level, where what I talked about, at this level, they are not important. I mean, you can decide that you don't want them, and that's consistent. That's it. Maybe that's all I can say. While the model of Joseph you were talking about is you cannot work without this disconnected stuff. You have a 5-4 terms which are disconnected, and you need to include them, otherwise the flow is not consistent. I don't see why. No.
So why in your specific model? That's
that has something to do with the field, with the structure of divergence. It's nothing to do with the geometry here. No, because the model of Joseph, it's the same setup. It's just that you have some what they call an anomaly term, which disconnects, and you have to include it in the flow. But it's a technical step. What? I would say that in this GFT context, these disconnected terms are not dangerous. I mean, there is no problem a priori from the field theory to include them if you have to. It's not, but it's just that you are in most of the models we looked at, you are free to work with the connected stuff and it's stable. But it's not that there is a conceptual obstruction to working with disconnected stuff. So maybe I'm done. Let me just say that you can start to implement simplicity constraints in this, the same formalism. We are looking at it with the Barrett-Crane type of simplicity constraints. And what you can see is that, as it is, it's not going to be renormalizable because of these Mellonic things which badly diverge. But the natural weights you get from the GFT are the ones that Valentin and Bianca studied. So we know the many things about the structure of divergences, and we know in particular that the badly divergent ones are only coming from these kind of pathological melonic structures. So if we could get rid of them by combinatorial restrictions, maybe there is a way to construct something interesting in 4D, still in this context. And as a funny thing also, in D equals 3, if you do the deconstruction, it will be renormalizable. But
so you see the divergences can only form
melonics? So I'm not completely sure of that, but the bad divergences come only from the melonic ones. Because in your paper, you studied the divergences coming from the faces of length 2. But here you have, with the melonic stuff, you have faces of length 1. And they don't see at all this twist because they cancel each other. And so it diverges badly. But in D equal 3, if you do that, the same. So you take still spin 4, do the same construction, but on three-dimensional complexes. You see that you get exactly the same power counting as the one I was talking before, so it's renormalizable in principle, but it's not in the D equal 4. That was just to say that you can implement the simplicity constraints, and maybe it makes more sense than in the maybe the Laplacian term is not as bad as in the 3D case, because when you put the Laplacian, you don't destroy neither the simplicity constraint nor the Gauss constraint. But it's not BF, just because you put the Laplacian, so you destroy the flatness. But here you put the Laplacian, but you don't destroy the flatness because there is no flat. I mean, I don't know. It's just a remark that when you impose simplicity constraints here, you put the Laplacian. It's just you turn the delta functions into heat kernels, but maybe not as bad because it doesn't obviously conflicts with the equations of motion. Maybe that's what I wanted to say. I mean, it doesn't obviously destroy the meat of the model. I don't know. Yeah. While in 3D, it obviously does because it destroys a flatness. Yeah, probably for a good reason. But you can do it. Okay, and maybe I'll stop here. I wanted to just say that it would be handy to be able to compare the consistent boundary formulation in GFT. But at this stage, there are many different structures, in particular the fact that in one case you are embedded, in the other case not. The fact that in one case you kind of hope to understand the diffeomorphisms well, but in the other it's a bit harder because you have to realize them as a field symmetries. And maybe here the difficulty is that you don't have one parameter scale. Well, here yes, but maybe I don't know. Maybe there's a way of mixing the two ways of thinking. And I think that would be handy because we know that in usual field theory, lattice methods and momentum shell methods are pretty much complementary. And but I think if one wants to go along this route, well, one needs two things. So first, to develop a lattice approach without embedding, so which would be compatible with the GFT. And on the GFT side, think more about the boundary states, because for now we didn't think at all about them. And diffeomorphism symmetry. But that's more like to maybe open up the discussion. But in any case, I expect that there will be interesting exchanges of ideas from the two perspectives. For example, in the GFT, the fact that there is a new vacuum on the consistent boundary side opens up the question also whether we can build a new vacuum in GFT. So that's it. I'm done.